He put me up here.
Initially, I expect to stop this whole process, which it did. It did for 10 years. And that was God's will. But it was not God's will that they do what they did to me. That was man's will. That was their will. And, you know, it's effective. Don't agree with it. I could never agree with it. When man's will is to harm his neighbor and keep him from prospering, it's wrong. And that's basically that's all they did. The many, many years that I was there. So, you know, we're coming up on that day when I'm going to do what I have to do. And we'll see what happens. I know that, you know, it's God's will. It's going to be, God's will be done. It's not mine. So we'll see once what happens. That's just the way it is. You know, all the, it's about 8:30 in the evening on the 13th. Most of the documentation between me and the town while this was going on, and between me and this attorney Dietze, has been put on paper, and it's in a plastic bag in the back of the Subaru. And there's a chronological order there, but I don't have that with me here, so I'm kind of jumping around. But it's in there, and if you put it together, how it happened, it's all there, and that will basically back up what I'm saying. It's also in the computer I have here, which I think I downloaded a lot of that stuff onto paper, and that's what's in the Subaru. But the computer is gonna go to South Dakota. And it'll be stored where it's supposed to be, and I would hope that the people that have it for one day could figure it out to know the truth. And I guess if they do figure it all out, and they still figure I'm wrong, well, that's the way they figure. That's the way people figure. I don't think that. I would be making this tape. I don't think I'd be still sitting here, you know, 2-3 years after all this stuff was done, 4 years, whatever. It'd still be bothering me. It took my whole retirement away. I've got no life. The life I've got, sure, I've got a life if you want to settle for that kind of a life. But that's not what I've been taught to do. You settle for things if that's the way it goes. If I had gone bankrupt and lost a muffler shop with the property and went to an auction later on, the FDIC got it back or whatever, and I went to that auction and I didn't bring enough money with me to buy it, that's a good sign, you know, that I shouldn't have it back and that I should go do something else. But if I was supposed to have it, if I was supposed to continue on, if I was supposed to get it back, I would have bought it. And that would be a good sign to go on. But Cody didn't bring enough money. And he lost. And he just has refused to give it up. The town, because their plans that they made for rezoning that 2 acres, when they rezoned Gus Harris's 2 acres south of me, when I stepped in, you know, when God put me there to buy that property, and, you know, their plans were done with, they were eliminated, they were stopped, you know, they should have moved on. They should have looked for a better place. And I know Cody wanted to, this is something important, he wanted to concrete plant to be out there by Hot Sulphur Springs, just east of Hot Sulphur Springs. And, you know, I didn't really care. I didn't go to any of the meetings or anything. But they turned it down. And it was way outside of town. It was downwind of the town. But this was very interesting. And this is why we should have had a change of venue in the court proceedings. We should have had this moved to Steamboat. Because the judge who sat at our trial, the judge had gone to those meetings in 97. I believe it was 97 when Cody tried to get that out there by Hot Sulphur Springs. The judge owned property across the highway to the north. And the judge and his wife went to the meetings for the county to oppose this concrete plant being there because it was going to devalue their property. And the letters are there at the county, at the Hot Sulphur Springs, the courthouse there. And I found this out a couple of weeks after I lost the case. I heard somebody said that he had fought this judge had. And so I went down to the court and I found these records, and there's copies of those are in the back of that Subaru, I believe. His letter from his wife and what she said. And these were strictly, you know, from the judge's heart. It wasn't from his wife, it was from him, because he was at those meetings. And it's right in the record. For when you go to those meetings, you have to sign in, and he signed in. And he should have recused himself from doing this, but by doing what he did, by making the judgment in favor of the Doshefs and the town, he ensured that it would never come back to be at that location in the gravel pit across from his property. And, you know, my attorney, as paid off as he was, however they got to him, or whatever his thinking was, he even told me that I should write the judge and ask him to set aside his verdict, and that we should have a new judge redo it. But you know, what was the point? I spend another $50,000 with this attorney so that we go fight it someplace else? You know, that's all he was doing, was making money on the deal. He didn't care if I win or lose. As a matter of fact, in one of the letters he sent me, which is a copy in the computer and in the back of the Subaru, he said that he wouldn't appeal it. I always told him, I said, Dietz, if this is good enough to take to court the first time in the face of all the negative feelings that I have about winning it, I said, it's good enough if we lose to appeal it to a higher court. Dietzel wouldn't do it. He would not appeal it. Even after I told him that the judge had fought this concrete plant when it was going to be across from his property, which wasn't even downwind of the property. You know, it was right beside it, but it was for the most part upwind of the darn concrete plant. And it property wouldn't have been affected near as badly as my property was, or the town property of my neighbors. And anyway, Dietz said that he would not appeal it, and he said this in a letter, because he had future cases coming up in front of Judge Doucette, and he felt that if he appealed Judge Doucette's ruling, that it would affect adversely on him in these other cases. Well, I'm sorry, I don't know what that is called, but without a doubt, it was wrong. You know, if he was willing to take my money for all those months and years that we fought this thing, convincing me all along that we were going to win, that it was the right thing, I was doing the right thing, you know, he really should have done it without being paid. But and I should have been smart enough to tell him that clear back there when we had the, when they made that resolution in 2000, that he shouldn't get paid anymore. You know, but I didn't know, I didn't know about how towns operate. Especially, I didn't know they were that crooked. So, you know, I made a mistake. I made a lot of mistakes. And what did they teach me? I mean, why? So I learned how to go to FDIC auctions, maybe, and buy property. And if there was the previous owner bid against me at the future auctions when I bought this property, that I would just sell it real quick. What good does that do me when I'm 65 years old, if that's when the FDIC starts selling properties that have been foreclosed on again, if there's a glut of those on the market because the economy drops? I don't need that kind of money at 65. I needed it when I was in my 40s and my 50s. That's when it should have been here, and it's not here. So the money that I've got is of no use to me, because I am not going to live the life they want me to live. You know, they think that I should have to stay down there in Granby. I should have kept my muffler shop going. I should have put up with all the dust, all the snickers, you know, the town council. I'd pass them in the post office, and they'd snicker at me after they knew I lost. On the street, Casey Farrell. I mean, the guy, what a barbarian, you know. He's just a very sick man. He comes across as being one of those good guys, and he's nothing like that at all. He's part of the problem. As we're with that whole system down there, you know, the good old boy system. When you come up against a person like me, you know, you gotta help me. Throw me a bone. You wouldn't throw me anything. You know, you couldn't. I mean, when Cody first came to those meetings, he said he would put up walls and he would do all this different stuff. We don't have any of it. It doesn't make any sense. Other than that, it was the good old boys patting each other on the back. Well, you should have made me, if not one of the good old boys, you should have given me a bone to get out of there so that I could leave you alone and do what you wanted. You know, I put the property up for sale almost as soon as this PDO started. Get me out of here. But you couldn't read that. If you did, you read it so that you said, ha, we got him. We know he wants to get out of there. We know he knows he's screwed. Let's really screw him, you know? That's exactly what their attitude was. And they did, you know? I had no choice. What was I supposed to do? So when I had my auction, these people, I netted, when I sold the property by myself to Travis Bussey and his partner Bob, I netted $400,000 on the sale because I didn't use a realtor. At the auction, I would have had to pay the auctioneer 10% of the sales price to net the $400,000. I had it listed as a minimum reserve of $450,000. And remember, I am forfeiting my business. Goodwill, what I would call equity, I'm giving it up. And I says, look, if I advertise it at a minimum of $450,000, we pay 10% of that to the auctioneer. That leaves me with $405,000. If they would have bought it at that auction for $450,000, I would have walked away. But there wasn't one bid. And it also is unique how I had five things that were reserved at the auction. The bulldozer, the land, a Kobelco backhoe, my 72 Nova, and a pair of jet skis. It is unique how the jet skis made the minimum, the Kobelco made the minimum, the Nova went over the minimum, and they sold. But what two things did I keep? The Komatsu dozer and the property. So stop and think about this. I wasn't supposed to walk away from this, because the Komatsu was still there.
The property was still there. If I would have gotten a bid of $450,000, I would have netted $5,000 more than I actually netted. Is that what it cost for you people to not pay? Because what I'm going to do is going to be worth way more than the $5,000 if you get... I know I'm not very good explaining this, but I hope you get my drift here. You know, you blew it. Maybe you say it didn't happen because it would have cost you $50,000 extra than what I actually netted. Well, you were telling everybody, Cody was telling everybody that I talked to that the property was only worth $300,000. Well, Cody, you were lying to people because I netted $400,000. I would have netted $405,000 had I sold it at the auction. You guys could have gotten rid of me. But that was one of those things that said, God, if it brings $450,000, I'm out of here. I'm done. I'll forget it. I'll live. I'll get on with my life. It did bring it. It didn't bring it. It just amazes me that it didn't, because I was so close to walking away from this. Anyway, so I got the dozer and I got the building. Another thing that was very, very unique was, now how am I going to do, what am I going to do with this dozer? Okay, I had it up on the driveway for sale, and according to the Ritchie Brothers auction sales at that time, that dozer was selling nationally for as much as $43,000. Okay, I don't believe that any of the Komatsu D355s were as in good a shape as this one was. This Komatsu was owned by, I believe it was Fresno Tractor. And they'd owned it for about 6 years and had rented it out. And this Komatsu was in excellent condition. If any Komatsu D355 should have brought $54,000, which is what I had it at, that one should have. I was willing at the auction to take $33,000 for it. Couldn't get a bid. I got a $20,000 bid. That was the only real bid we got. Well, I had $24,000 in it. I'm not going to sell it for that, especially when Ritchie Brothers says it's worth $43,000. So I kept the dozer. What was unique, after everything's gone, I find out that the dozer is 2 inches shorter than 12 feet and will go into the storage building. It is 1 inch narrower than the door if I take the little bottom, the out edge, the edging grousers off, or whatever they call them on the dozer blade. If I take those off, that dozer will go in my storage building. So I says, well, let's put it inside, because then I can build it to do what I am supposed to do. And I could not believe it. I put up a 4x8 piece of plywood on each side of the door so that the blade would go through, drove that thing up there, got out to where the cab was close to the door, checked the clearance, and I had 2-3 inches of clearance. I drove it right in there. It fit through that door so tight you almost had to grease it to get it in there. Why did that particular dozer fit in the building? Why had I not bought one of the D9s at that Fresno auction? It doesn't make any sense. You know, a D9's got more horsepower. It's probably more dependable than a Komatsu. If I'd have bought one of them, I'd have never got it in that building, because they were much taller than the Komatsu was. So I'm thinking, well, this is good. I get it inside. Now I can build it. Must be what I'm supposed to do. Put it inside under the guise that, you know, it's winter time. I'm not going to be here. Everything's sold. I don't have a muffler shop anymore. I'm going to go snowmobiling. I got to keep it out of the weather, and I got to keep it away from the friggin' criminals down there in Granby who are going to come by and sabotage it, which did happen to my place more than once in the 11 years that I was down there. People would steal different things and so forth. I mean, it's a sick town. Other than have the store that I had in Commerce City, the muffler shop, which got broke into one time, I never had any problems with theft in any of the businesses that I ever owned or any of the shops that I ever run. But in Granby, I had problems.
And there may be good reasons for that, because it wasn't sitting on a main street and so forth, and you whatever, you know. But there were more break-ins in my building in Granby than any business I have ever owned. There was four, to be exact. Three were attempted, I should say, where they didn't get in, or if they did, they didn't take anything. The one time that they did take anything, they stole some wheels off of a street rod that I had sitting in front of the building. And those people got caught. And I got restitution from one of them. There were three kids. One of them paid his restitution. The other two, for all I know, they're in jail today. But it's just the way that town is. It's just, you know, they're poor. Right now, I think that everybody's probably got a lot of money in their pockets, because we've had pretty good economy up here the last 5 or 6 years. But as those people all could have $1 million each, they would still be poor. They're poor in mind, they're poor in pocketbook, they're poor in spirit, they're poor in heart. They're just poor people. And I don't know, you know, it's they need to stop thinking that they need to. They have to get some self-esteem, some self-respect, and love their neighbors, and not try to deprive them of a right to make a living, to have their dreams realized. And it's sad that people down there do that. And I'm talking about the leaders of the community. They keep people down, because if they didn't, the real cream of the crop would rise to the top and knock them from their position. But of course, their definition of cream of the crop is to see how devious you can be to screw your neighbor. If you're devious enough and you're smart enough and wily enough to screw your neighbor, then you're the cream and you should be on top. You shouldn't earn it through doing honest, hard work. You have to get together, have secret meetings. You have to spend years conniving, waiting for an opportunity to screw your neighbor. Well, I've never done it, and I ain't planning on doing it, other than what I'm doing now. And this will be the first time that I've ever done something like that, the way they want it to be done, the way they do it, to do it in secret, to do things behind their back, to lie to you when you ask them what their plans are, and they won't tell you. I've had to do that. People ask me, what am I doing? Oh, I'm not doing anything. I spent the whole summer of 2003 in that friggin' building, lived there without a shower for as much as four days at a time, working on that dozer, getting it prepared to do what I have to do. And it was, that's another thing that was so uncanny. We'll talk about getting caught. Why didn't I get caught? Why haven't I been caught? Or why didn't I get caught up to now? Last fall, when Travis and Bob go to buy the place, they need to have their insurance man come in and see the storage building. They want to see inside. Now, I had put up a temporary wall, and I had insulated that whole building that summer, and had started working on this dozer. I had this dozer about half done, by maybe three-quarters done, by the time they wanted this insurance guy to come in. I had to clean that whole shop up, hide all the steel, the welders, hide all that stuff in a little room in the corner I built out of 2x4s and canvas. And then what did I do? I took polypropylene tarps and I covered the dozer, which I had the whole cab armor on. I had about half of the engine armor on. And I covered it up with tarps and taped it all shut. And I says, you know, maybe this is where I'm supposed to get caught. They're going to come in here and they're going to get nosy. They're going to want to know what's under this dozer. They're going to find out that what I'm building this. And, you know, somebody's going to go call the cops and they're going to put a stop to it. Well, that's the way it's supposed to be. Catch me, okay? They came in there after I had the shop all cleaned up, had this, everything put away, had the dozer covered up with these polypropylene tarps. I even put a lift in there to lift all this steel onto the dozer. This lift was
about 20 feet long, had a 20-foot arm on it with a electric winch, and it swung on a post. And that's how I lifted all this steel to get it on there. Okay, the lift is there. So these guys come in. Oh, wow, what's this? This is the dozer. Oh, okay. Well, what's this lift, they say. And I say, well, I made up this story about this guy from Minnesota who was a professor at the university there and was working on a system to, it was called, I can't even think of it right now, when you deep freeze things. Cryogenics or something like that. I said this professor was perfecting a cryogenics cooling system to go in the intake of the diesel engine, which would cool the air and increase the performance of the engine and increase the hourly fuel consumption. And they bought it. I says, but the lift goes when I leave. You know, when this guy comes to pick his dozer up after he's done all this testing, you know, we put this lift in so we could lift this big 800-pound condenser up on the back, you know, which he had mismeasured, and they had to take it back to Minnesota, and then he's got this other evaporator that we had to lift, plus the pump has got to go on there. We're running that off of a drive, an auxiliary drive, PTO drive that they've got on the engine. I had this all bullshit story, and they went along with it. You know, I said, I couldn't believe it when they walked out the door. I'm safe. How come they didn't catch me? It was right there under their nose. Well, I wasn't supposed to get caught. Not yet. Maybe I will. Maybe this whole thing will come to stop early. That's the way it's supposed to be. I will accept that. They took away my life. They took away my future. They took away my hope. They took away any desires that I had. I cannot operate in a community of people that does that to their neighbors. I wasted 13 years of my life down there because the Thompsons were pissed off that I bought that property. You put yourself in my shoes and tell me how you would feel at 50 years old realizing that you've wasted 10 years of your life because of someone's malice, because of their jealousy, because of their greed, because of their hate. I'm 52 now. That's why I talk about 12, 13 years. You know, it was 10 years then. You know, it just isn't right. I cannot... There used to be a time when I could withstand these types of losses. I could never afford them. You can never afford to lose money. You can withstand it and you can recover sometimes. Most of the time I looked at it that way, it was because I was young and I was strong and I could go out and physically do the work. I'm 52 now. I can't do it. I can't withstand it. I can't recover. We're talking about losing $300,000, which along with the sale of the property would have been my retirement, would have let me go on to do other things to make more wealth. But when you take 10 years of my life away and just piss it down the drain and are happy about it and ecstatic about it, no. I've taken all I can take. How I react, yes, it's a reaction. That's how it's supposed to be. That's how God built me. You know? It is not my fault. What did that one guy say? Those who made me your enemies, or enemy, those who made me your enemy, they are the guilty ones.
The Thompsons are guilty. The Dochefs are guilty. The Granby Town Board is guilty. The Granby Planning Commission is guilty. My neighbors are guilty. It took all of you 10 years to get me. And you got me, no doubt about it. I got screwed big time. We talked today about it to Dave Patner. He knows I got fucked. And he knows that they do it. And they get away with it. There's nothing you can do about it, he says. Well, I'm going to do something about it. It may only change people for a generation. Maybe two. May not change them at all. Maybe make them worse. That's the way it's supposed to be. And that's the way it will be. God's will be done. Through me. We're going to fly.